The recording started.
Thank you. I'll do the roll call for you, Edmund. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the JIG call on the 31st of August. And on the call, we have Samad Hussain, Rafik Damak, Edmund Chung, Avery Doria, David Gowan, and Andrei Koleshnikov. And we have apologies from Fade Batanik and Jane, too, I believe, Edmund?
Yeah.
And
she sent it into the list. I don't know whether people got her email.
I will just have a look. It's probably somewhere along in my emails. And please, may I remind you to say your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, Edmund. Over to you.
Thank you, Glenn. So thanks again for everyone taking time and joining the call. I guess I sent around a revised document earlier today. Again, apologize for it being so late, but I sort of got it around. Hopefully you have it with you or might have the chance to take a look at it. The changes that were incorporated included a number of items that were discussed last time. I'll just quickly go over it so people are aware. I had it in the email as well, but so there were four main points that were changed. First of all, Olaf's suggestion that in the holding pattern part, to where there is an overlap, to not allow such occurrences in the holding pattern approach, and then Avery's suggestion on combining the aspect 1 and 2. Those are from the previous version. So right now it just says aspect 1 and incorporates the sort of what constitutes an IDN variant and what is what sort of the framework for IDN language policy. And then we added two aspects which were discussed last time. And they're added as number four, aspects number four and number five. Number four being, we talked a little bit about the requirement for sort of the behavior or the content of the zones that are directly managed by a TLD operator for an IDN variant TLD. And then number five was that was brought up, I believe, by Samad about adding what process should there be in terms of the when an IDN variant TLD needs to be added subsequent to the initial delegation of the primary IDN. We also added the concept of base IDN, which is distinct from primary IDN. We had a discussion on this. there are certain scenarios in the Arabic, for example, Arabic script situation where you might want a primary IDN, which is the primary presentation or the string that is being presented, and then a base IDN for the generation of variants. There are certain situations that may require that. But it, all in all, they're largely the same for most situations. But I guess it's good in terms of us defining a sort of a framework to be able to describe all different scenarios. And then I added, just in the version one, the background session was really just a bunch of links. I added a number of write-ups. A write-up basically on the background and quoting some of the, I guess some of the parts where I thought were important and should inform our discussion here. And then I also added some additional write-up for some of the aspects that we have talked about. So I guess with that, starting with the few changes that incorporates the discussion last time, is there? I just want to open up and see if I missed something that we talked about and was not reflected in what I said. If anyone remembers.
Edmund, this is Olaf here. Well, first of all, kudos for great work on developing the paper. I think you've turned all the stones, I think. Found a lot of good background material. I've got a little question. Starting from, we do it in Arabic, so we read it from back to front here. So the very last bullet point, I think there's, I agree with what you say, but I think the example doesn't include a rather necessary negation. So it should say, cannot be allowed to proceed separately.
Oh. Apologies. I changed the earlier part and missed changing the latter part. That's my...
Okay, so... I read the whole document all the way to the bitter end.
No, that's thank you. It's an omission. There should be a cannot. There should be a not between can and be in the last sentence.
Okay, thanks.
Hearing no particular comment, we could probably resume where we left off. Last time we talked about mainly on some issues and then aspect one and sort of the basic framework of sort of an IDN language policy. Perhaps we can start today with the discussion on aspect two, following from last time. I've actually, for aspect two, I have also added some description there. Aspect two, again, for those who, if you don't have the document in front of you, was identified as the types of IDN variants with respect to their allocation and delegation properties. So I think the aspect itself is pretty self-explanatory in a way, but really what I wanted to talk about is how a policy framework should look at the types of IDN variants. I started by building on the IDN implementation working team final report. In fact, that's the basis of most of the discussion at the JIG anyway. So starting from there, in that report, there was a sort of a classification of type 1 variants and type 2 variants. Type 1, the report mentioned type 1 variants as visually identical, and type 2 as being not visually identical but considered equivalent otherwise. When sort of looking deeper into the report, the report then does not really distinguish between any operative policies. Last time, I sort of used this term. I don't know whether if anyone is not comfortable with this term, please bring it up again. I used the term operative policy, saying that something described as policy that can be implemented and can be operated upon. What I'm looking at, type 1 and type 2, it doesn't seem like it's being used, because in the report later on, it says that, most of the discussion then says either type 1 or type 2, the same operation, the same policy sort of is applied. Rather than sort of those type of type 1 and type 2, the report actually identified another way of looking at the types of variants, which are called desired variant and undesired variant. So the report then goes on to say how to deal with a desired variant or an undesired variant in a policy manner. So I think for our work here, it's probably better to expand or work on the classification of desired variant or undesired variant, which has implications towards whether they are put in the zone or into the root or not, and focus on that aspect and that view to sort of develop a kind of classification for the types, and thereupon we can further develop sort of a policy framework for dealing with IDN variants if we look at it in these types, which is basically in the report it says that for desired variants they may be allocated and delegated. For undesired variants, they may be allocated but will not be delegated. So based on, you know, this building on this framework, I think, you know, we can probably flesh it out a little bit more. I wonder if I'm making sense, and I think those who had participated in the IDM working team perhaps can add to this. I'm not sure if Samar is here and may want to add on whether this might make sense, you know, to not use the type 1, type 2, but rather focus on the properties for which is described by desired variants and undesired variants.
Okay, I think type 1 and type 2 are labels from a user's perspective, and desired, undesired are perhaps more from a delegational perspective.
Right.
So, you know, obviously, you know, I agree if you're talking about so type 1, type 2 are just a notional kind of way to understand or actually make it explicit that variants are not necessarily things which look same. Variants actually could be things which look very different to each other as well.
Right.
So I think type 1, type 2 terminology was introduced to sort of make that distinction very explicit. And then desired, undesired is focused more on whether that particular variant, whether it's type 1 or type 2, is needed by the users or should be delegated or not delegated. So, again, as I said, two different views.
Right. That's sort of what I got as well. So, for our discussion here, it seems to me that it makes more sense to focus on the desired and undesired sort of classification.
Yeah, sure. Agree.
So,
can I ask a question? This is Aubrey.
Please.
Okay. First of all, I want to check on something, and I think that perhaps this question is pure pedantry. So I apologize. But the equivalence, and perhaps this is quoted somewhere, and I just never noticed it before, orthographic tends to just mean sort of spelling or a different form of visual, and I don't think goes necessarily as far as semantically equivalent. But perhaps I'm wrong in that, and I'm just trying to make sure that we've got terminology straight. The other thing is, it strikes me, and I'm just wondering, whether somehow maintaining both of these notions might not end down the road end up more helpful and giving you sort of a matrix, and I'm hand waving on that, not being really sure. But as they are two ways of looking at it that don't overlap, they might give us a sort of more controlled way of looking at various types of that's a bad sentence, but various types of variants. In terms of not just having it be, because the other difference is one is somewhat objective and one is largely subjective and requires a policy decision to say which category you fall in. And so I'm just wondering whether there isn't some value in looking at keeping both and using them together as opposed to just jettisoning the first one, but it's just a thought. Thank you.
Sure. Avery, your first question was on the use of orthographic. That is a direct quote from the report, so that's why I didn't change it. And you would see that I don't use that term in other parts of the document precisely for the reason that you
mentioned. They mean, I'd have to go back to the report. I read it a while back. Did they make a, I keep using the same word in two different ways in a sentence. It's very difficult. Do they juxtapose semantic equivalence with orthographic equivalence as being the same thing?
I'm not sure. Samar, do you recall?
Actually, I don't recall this either, but I am not sure whether we went all the way to semantic equivalence, because then that brings in a whole lot of other things.
I think so as well. I believe it was just, you know, really used as, you know, this is the extent of what it was there to. It does go on to, you know, just talk a little bit more about the, you know, there are cases like this and that, but I think in the annex, but I don't think there was any additional discussion about.
This is Aubrey again, sorry for talking too much, but in some sense then we have, even though if no one named it, a type 3, which is anything beyond orthographic equivalence. Even though, I mean, people have constantly spoken of it, not in terms of being type 3, but in terms of, you know, there's the identical, there's the similar, and then there's the equivalent by virtue of some other property. And I don't know whether that's something, but we might want to not have in the report something that looks like we're juxtaposing semantic with orthographic. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, Avery, I think that's a good point, and that sort of flows into your second question on, you know, how I want to look at this, because therein lies the, I guess, my problem, a little bit problem with the type 1, type 2, and then type 3 classification, because it could go on. It's also sort of my view that the view of type 1, type 2, as Samad just mentioned, is more on the user's view, and also it's when you develop an idea and language policy, when you develop the policy as let's say, for example, as a registry or as a language community, that's when you look at the type 1, type 2, or type 3 type classification and design the policy around that. But here in this discussion, I guess we're focused on not ICANN shouldn't be developing these IDN policies, but rather, you know, looking at these IDN policies, how we can act on it. And that's sort of the reason I use operative ones instead of just general. And on the operational level, I think it's really looking at, okay, given a language policy, when ICANN implements it, takes an application and try to implement it into the root, what should be done? Because if we go down the path of trying to define how, you know, all the different types of variants in a linguistic or user point of view, that could be an endless, all the people in this room or, you know, in the whole ICANN community might not be covering all the situations for all the languages. So we will never get a good set there. But if we focus our efforts on, you know, given a language table, how do we then implement it into the root zone? It seems to me that would be a more fruitful discussion, and that's why I sort of say, okay, let's, you know, for this discussion, perhaps we should set aside type 1 and type 2 or that type of view, and then, you know, focus on the desired and undesired, which has implications on allocation and delegation.
This is Olaf, if I may contribute. Well, I believe that you're very right, Edmund, in the sense that we talk about variants. I think it's useful to stop where the possibility to produce a variant doesn't extend beyond what how you can do it with the help of a language table or variant table or call you whatever you please. Other kinds of equivalence that really opens up very widely, and I'm not sure whether it's useful to call those variants. So I would rather go for, or would prefer, more stringent definition like you have in type 1 and type 2 here, rather than saying that a type 3 would be a variant as well. I think a variant label is something that you can produce with variant characters from a variant table or language table, whatever you prefer. I mean, rather restrictive view perhaps, but that's the way we used to do it in the GNSO IDN working group. That was sort of the concept which was used for variants at the time. It may develop, of course.
Hi. This is Aubrey again. I think that is actually a good thing to do. I think you'd have to correct the wording here that lists semantically equivalent in the paragraph. And it might be good to explicitly exclude those things before moving on. I think that you know, Olaf is making an excellent point. That it's one of the problems that I was having is the drift in the notion of variant to the so-called type 3 that is not a variant type. So I think that's a great suggestion, and being explicit about that is a good thing.
That's a good idea, Avery. I think, you know, probably we should add some wording as to sort of suggest that we have looked into somewhat into this, and shouldn't say we've looked into it. We've sort of opened the lid and say, okay, let's close this lid now and, you know, move on to more constructive discussion. Does that work for you in terms of, yeah, I think we probably should add a paragraph just saying what you just said in terms of, okay, this path, you know, about semantic or, you know, many other types of variants may not be relevant for the policy discussion at the ICANN scope.
Again, I think that would make sense. That would work for me. I think you may still need, even with the strict nomenclature of type 1, type 2, as defined by the IDN working group, you may need also to consider showing a linkage, a mapping between those to your new categories, since those are existing categories that people talk about and that are useful. So it may also be necessary, if not following the matrix view, and I understand why not doing that, to at least show the relationship so that we don't end up with an apples and rocks comparison at the end in terms of, yeah, well, we were talking about type 1 and type 2, and you're talking about, you know, these other forms of differentiation, and we don't know how they map to each other.
Ah, I see. That's a good point. I have a note here. I agree with that. I think it will definitely add value to it. But I do want to point out also a couple of things, actually. This type 1, type 2 is not from the GNSO working group, just so that you are clear. It's from the IDN working team that was assembled.
Yes, sorry,
later.
I used working group instead of team.
That's okay. The other thing is that the desired variance and undesired variance, that classification was also in the work team report. So I'm really just building on that view. In fact, the report actually later just builds on the desired variant and undesired variant view as well, because that's when, you know, that's the operative part. Okay. So, building on that, in the working team final report, it identified the desired variance and undesired variance, and it basically it says that a desired variance are those that may be allocated and also may be delegated, whereas undesired variance may be allocated but will not be delegated. I was looking at it a little more deeply and thought that perhaps splitting it into three types might be more useful. The first one being that it will be allocated and delegated together with the primary IDN. That I sort of took the nomenclature from the CDNC documents calling it preferred IDN variants. And then the second type being that it will be allocated, but may be delegated. So it's not automatic. It's not delegated with the primary, but it may be delegated later. So, and again, using the CDNC nomenclature, calling them reserved IDN variants, and then the third type being blocked IDN variants. And these ones would be unallocated and not allowed for further application. So, and this I felt that this might be a better description, because then, as you can see in my write-up, the preferred IDN variants are generally desired variants, but reserved IDN variants seem to be either desired or undesired variants could be in that type as well, and then blocked IDN variants. But then by distinguishing these three types, then we can immediately, as an ICANN perspective, you would immediately understand whether this should be delegated together with the primary, or whether this would be optional and the applicant could apply or activate to delegate it at a later time. And the third type being that, you know, it's just simply blocked. You know, it cannot be allocated and cannot be, it's not available for further application. Does that make sense for people?
Hey, this is Arman. One comment I have is that for the reserved IDN variants, I'm not sure what everybody else feels, but I think limiting it to just the desired variants shouldn't that be sufficient, and undesired variants should always be blocked? So what I'm saying is that the undesired variant should not be reserved.
Okay, but in the IDN working team final report, it says that undesired variants may be allocated, but will not be delegated. That's the part. In fact, you know, elaborate on that. What the thinking was in terms of that recommendation?
Actually, reserved to me means that it is something which may eventually be which may become live at a later stage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas blocked is something which is dead forever.
Okay.
So the way I understand these three levels is preferred is something which will be live immediately. If
mm-hmm.
one is not sure about something, one can keep it in a limbo state, so it's not live right now, but may become live or not
mm-hmm.
become live later on, but it doesn't work, so that's reserved. And if one is sure that this is something which is not needed, one actually goes and blocks it, which means that there is no chance of making it live again. So the difference between reserved and blocked is that reserved, both are not live, and they will not resolve, either one, neither reserved nor blocked. But the reserved one may resolve at a later stage, but blocked will never be able to be resolved, even at a later stage.
Right. I think that makes a lot of sense. And it now seems to me that perhaps I read it a little bit I had a mistake in reading it. So what you're saying is really, if I read now the report again, then there is a scenario where something is allocated but cannot ever be delegated.
Exactly.
What I'm asking, so maybe there should be a fourth type. What I should describe four types. The first type being preferred, which is allocated and delegated, you know, just right off the bat. Second one, it's allocated, it's not delegated, but it could be delegated. The third one, it's allocated, but can never be delegated and cannot be activated.
And
the fourth one is not allocated and never delegated.
That fourth one is not a category, because that is true for all the strings which are not applied for so far. So all the strings currently are unallocated.
But it wouldn't be blocked, because it could be a situation where it's not allocated to the registry, but it is just simply blocked, isn't it?
So what I'm saying is that allocated and delegated are not two independent variables. So one has to apply, and then the delegation occurs. So first, it has to be allocated before it can actually be delegated. So you cannot have an unallocated and delegated kind of scenario. That's what I'm saying. The fourth one doesn't.
Am I correct to understand that there is no such thing as an unallocated IDN variant? So, because if it's an IDN variant for a TLD, then it's always allocated. The only issue we should look at is whether it's immediately delegated, optionally delegated later, or can never be delegated.
Exactly. So those are the three variations.
I'm comfortable with that classification. Seems to make a lot of sense to me. Anyone have any thoughts?
Olaf again. I think that makes sense. I'm just sitting and figuring who decides, who sort of, as I understand it, desired or undesired, that's wholly up to the applicant to specify that it is desired or undesired. So from that perspective, I just found it, if it's wholly up to the applicant to actually put forward something as preferred, reserved, and blocked, well, it wouldn't make sense, like just was mentioned, to have reserved something that's undesired, perhaps. But I'm not really sure, where do you see in the process that the notion of preferred, reserved, and blocked comes about? Is it sort of the preference expressed from the applicant, or is there some vetting process, or is it just here where the policy would actually apply and according to some nifty rules still to be developed, would be able to identify as preferred, reserved, blocked, or whatever, some kind of rules that would put the one or the other, perhaps in opposition to what the applicant has requested. Is that the whole idea, or is this something that's decided somewhere else?
I think that's a very good point, and that sort of brings me back to aspect one, and I sort of brought this up, but I think this is probably the right time to talk about it, is that what you mentioned is that if we depend solely on the applicant, and the applicant would create a kind of language policy which would which could be, for lack of a better word, gamed or abused in order to try to get an additional TLD, to put it in the worst case, right? I think that probably the best way is to look at it in the sense that who decides is really it's dependent on the way I see it is that it depends on the IDN language policy, and it's the IDN language policy is a combination of the IDN language tables and the IDN variant tables. And one critical element to guard somewhat against the abusive usage of such things are two things. One, that the registry must be using, which is currently true anyway, the registry must be using that same language policy for second level registration. So if something, I guess, abusive is being used, that wouldn't work for the second level registrations anyway. And the second point being that I think all through the IDN GTLD, the GNSO working group, we talked about the importance of some engagement to get a sanity check from language communities. And I think even in the fast track process, there is sort of like a sanity check already. I think that those two together, and then a framework for what an IDN language policy should look like, and then the IDN variants being a product of that, rather than I want this string as well, and then I think it's a preferred variant by the applicant, then that would fail the test from described in aspect one.
Okay, fine. I just was aiming at, is this something that the preferred, reserved, or blocked, is this something that's requested by the applicant, allotted in the allocation process, or just a plain de facto status notice for the variants in question? It was rather, where in the process does this get defined?
Okay, hi, this is Samad. I just want to probably add, and that is that there are two steps involved here. The first step is determining, so given an application, the first step is determining whether all the variants are actually variants or not, or is there any abuse in it. That's a first step before this decision. Once it is decided that there are X amount of variants which are legitimate and they are going to be given to the applicant, then as a second step, I think that's from what my understanding is, that the categorizing these legitimate variants into desired or undesired is probably a business decision from the applicant themselves, and it's quite arbitrary. There is no it could be a, you know, any kind of argument, and that argument may be coming from a business angle, not from a linguistic angle at all, actually. So that's a second stage, and it's reasonably arbitrary, and actually it's defined by the applicant themselves, not in any algorithmic way.
This is Audrey. Can I add something?
Please go ahead.
Thanks. It seems to me that is the way it would go, is that people in their applications, or perhaps in a, you know, post-application request of some form or other, and, you know, that has yet to be designed, or a piece of process yet to be designed, would basically be the ones requesting these. But I think that, therefore, there probably is an equivalent process or judgment somewhere on, would this be a question, would this be a criteria upon which an application might be judged? Would this be something similar to a registry request that later might be judged? So I have a feeling that it really comes in on both sides of the equation. On it's something requested by an applicant or a registry, and it's something that is approved by someone or something else within a process. Now, that's just off the top of my head, but that would seem to be how it would have to flow process-wise.
Yeah, Avery, I think it sounds sensible to me as well. And Samad, I think... Yeah, I generally agree, and I guess with both Avi and you, in terms of step one and step two. The only thing I want to mention is that in terms of step two, between step one and step two, you mentioned that step two is really business consideration, which variant to be activated. From a Chinese perspective, that would really not be the case. I would see that there are certain, which is why I defined a type of preferred variant based on the CDNC, which is it has to be included, because if you want, I'll take Chinese for a specific example. If you have a, let's say, a traditional Chinese, you must also have the simplified Chinese, or else you are essentially in violation of the IDN language policies based on the CDNC language tables. Therein lies the something in between, I guess, step one and step two. In a lot of the cases where it's a reserved variant, so it's optional to the applicant whether or not to have it delegated, that's, you know, I guess what you mentioned by step two, and yes, that's, I think that's agreeable, that's a business consideration. But step one, I guess, involves not only identifying all the whole set of IDN variants, but also a subset of that IDN variants that needs to be preferred variants and must be included for delegation. And that's algorithmic. Does that make sense for you?
So what I was actually saying was that these two processes are separate from each other. So
right.
The first process may actually be algorithmic. That's okay. But the second process basically assumes that whatever the parameters for deciding in the first step were have been taken into consideration, and now we have a set of X variants which are legitimate. And based on those X different variants, it's now up to the person who's requesting to decide which one to put in which category, basically.
Right.
So what I'm probably trying understanding is that you're saying that the choice is not as free, where there are certain...
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that in step two, an applicant should not be able to designate a variant as preferred, reserved, or blocked. Those three types should be algorithmic. What in step two the applicant should be able to do is to decide if it's a reserved one, which is optional for the applicant, whether to, based on the IDN language policy, those are the ones that can be optionally activated, then those ones, it would be step two, and those are business consideration, and the applicant can choose. But in step one, it would already have identified those three by algorithmic, it would already have identified those three types, and they would be three subsets. Combining to become the whole set. And then out of which, the reserved variance part is the one that would go into step two. That's sort of how I see it.
Edmund, all of here.
Yeah.
It sounds like, I like that. No, it sounds like we're starting to discussing a flow chart and... Yeah, that's a helpful next step to clarify what comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a good way to categorize it. It's sort of like to describe it as in a flow chart. So in step one, and as Avery says, there is an evaluation process, which would include whether the whole application is good, for lack of a better word. Sorry. Then that's an evaluation process, and through which it also the language tables and everything that needs to be checked, and the whole set of IDN variants are created, because that's when you allocate everything, and then out of which comes step two, is then after the allocation of everything, then this step two is the delegation part. Step one does further identify which ones you can then activate in step two, right?
Yep.
And then that might require another round of evaluation, should that need to happen, as Avery mentioned.
Hi, this is Sarmad again. Sorry, I got dropped off. I really like this. I think this is really good, that actually the two-step process we were talking about is actually allocation and delegation. So I really do endorse this. So there is an allocation step which verifies whether variants are variants and so on and so forth. And then there's a delegation step, which tells that once those strings which are allocated, what level of priority should they be delegated right now, or maybe at a later stage, or never. So those were the three categories, right?
Right. That sounds good. Okay. That is essentially, you know, I'm looking at the document. That's essentially aspect three, which is what to do with the above information, and that's where it talks about allocation and delegation. So it seems like we can incorporate what we just discussed in a better form in this aspect three, which aspect three is really just the how we operate, you know, the step one, step two, I think would be... would be, I can add to that. I don't know whether I need to further.
Okay, this is Harmad again. I have a question. Did we, are we having any discussion on, so what are, again, further details within the allocation and delegation steps? Is that something which is left to a panel of experts or... is that something which is left to the applicant? If, you know, that's what we were discussing. I'm sorry, I missed a bit of a conversation. I got knocked off.
No, we should discuss it now. What do you have in mind in terms of you mean after the delegation, what should be done in you know in the second level, like as a registry? This is the thing for you.
No, I'm actually talking about this allocation and delegation process itself. So allocation is obviously going to be based on variant analysis by some external team of experts who are going to sit and do this, right?
Right.
What we were discussing was that how is delegation going to be? So is that what we what was the discussion? Is the delegation applicant's request or?
Yeah, you might have missed that part. I guess the one part that I think I want to add to that is that in the allocation process or step one, besides allocation, the expert should also confirm the set of IDN variants as you mentioned, and also which type they belong to. You know, the preferred or reserved. Or a blocked. So that whole thing is type step one. And then now in step two, in the delegation process, then for the ones that are preferred, that is automatically included in the initial delegation. It will be delegated. And for the reserved ones, the applicant then have an option to activate them, further delegated. And in that process, then we need another a sort of a service registry service. Might be sort of like an RCEP, but not exactly. We don't know yet, but there needs to be a process created such that for the ones that are reserved variants, and the applicant can then go through step two to have it delegated. We have not talked about the details of that process.
Edmund, this is Bart. Just to suggest that, say, for the next conference call, that, say, based on the categorization and process definition we now introduced, we revisit every step to determine which types of decisions and policies are needed around these steps to reach these different states. And I'm saying this because I'd say I'm not sure, but maybe we should check whether these different steps apply across the board, so between IDN CCTLDs and IDN GTLDs, or should they be distinguished? Because I can imagine around, say, the delegation process for new GTLDs is quite different than the delegation process for IDN CCTLDs or CCTLDs in general.
Right, you're very right. I think there is where you know what we just talked about. I think Samad is we identified this box that needs to fill in, but this process may be different between CCs and Gs.
Yes, but I think right. what the working group now unearthed is a very good framework to look at the different steps dealing with IDN variants across the board. And now we need to take a follow-up step by using this framework and see, first of all, if what are the suggested rules and decisions around each of these steps. And the next one is maybe even further, do they apply across the board or are they different for the, say, the GTLDs and CCTLDs. So that's two more steps before you end up in a reasonable, presentable document, I would say.
Right. I think that's a very good suggestion, and I think as you, and I agree with each of the steps, and in fact, some of the elements that we talked about, we should identify, you know, whether it applies, you know, how it, whether and how it applies to CCs and whether and how it applies to G, and you know whether or not they are they are consistent across, you know, across the board. Yeah.
Yes, and at least we have, I think, by this working group has unearthed a reasonable framework to discuss the whole issue about how to deal with variants in a structured manner.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about it. But we are at the top of the hour now.
Yeah.
I think we had a really constructive discussion today. I think we will continue this in 2 weeks' time. I'll revise the document based on the stuff we talked about, hopefully earlier next time. But also by next meeting, I think we will have completed the public comment period for the initial report for the single character IDNTLD. So I'd like to for next meeting in 2 weeks' time, we'll touch on that. Think about what needs to be the next steps for that as well, and also continue the discussion here on the IDN variants.
Edmund, this is Bart. In preparation of that meeting, I'll try to draft an overview of all the comments, and we'll send it to the working group.
That would be great.
Yep.
So, any items people want to raise before we close the call? If not, then thanks everyone for your time, and talk to all of you in 2 weeks.
Thanks, Edmund.
Thank you, Edmund. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.